Good morning. Israel is warning Hamas to hand over hostage remains more quickly. Families are also getting autopsy results. One says their son was killed by an Israeli airstrike. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Almost every news outlet covering the Pentagon, including NPR, is rejecting new restrictions on their work. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth had promised to make the Pentagon more transparent than ever. Also, a new podcast examines Nigerian music icon Fela Kuti, who fathered the Afrobeat sound while becoming the center of the movement against his country's military dictatorship. It's Wednesday, October 15th. On this day in 1976, Walter Mondale debated Bob Dole, a first for vice presidential candidates. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The federal government has been shut down for more than 2 weeks. Last night, Senate Democrats and Republicans failed again to agree on a spending bill to end it. President Trump has been firing federal workers since October 1st. A federal court will hold a hearing today over a lawsuit that claims the firings are illegal. Trump also says he will continue to target Democratic programs for closure during the shutdown. Israel and Hamas are exchanging the remains of those killed in the Gaza conflict. It's the first phase of the ceasefire. Hamas has turned over 8 bodies of hostages to Israel, but the Israeli military says it has determined one of those bodies was not a hostage. NPR's Greg Myrie reports the exchanges are a point of friction.
Israel handed over the remains of 45 Palestinians that were delivered to a medical complex in southern Gaza. Under the ceasefire deal, Hamas is supposed to return all 28 dead hostages, and Israel will return several hundred Palestinian bodies. Hamas says it needs more time to locate all the Israeli bodies due to the heavy fighting. Some may be buried under rubble. Israel told the United Nations it is reducing the amount of aid going into Gaza on Wednesday because it believes Hamas isn't doing enough to return the Israeli bodies. Greg Myrie, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
President Trump is strongly backing Argentina's president, who came to visit him yesterday at the White House. NPR's Giles Snyder says Trump is taking an unusual move.
President Trump is holding U.S. aid over the heads of Argentinian voters. During a White House meeting with President Javier Milei, Trump warned them not to abandon Milei. Milei is not on the ballot, but this month's election for seats in the National Congress is seen as a referendum on his policies. Milei was at the White House after the Trump administration provided his country with a $20 billion financial lifeline.
NPR's Giles Snyder reporting. The U.S. Supreme Court hears arguments today in a case that challenges the last major provision of the 1965 Voting Rights Act. This provision makes sure that minority voters don't get shut out when new congressional districts are being drawn up. NPR's Nina Totenberg has more.
When the law was passed in 1965, there were just 12 minority House members. Today, there are 134 Black, Hispanic, and Asian American House members. That could change, however, if the court removes the guardrails to redistricting that it endorsed as recently as 2 years ago. Indeed, if the conservative court majority either nullifies the redistricting provision of the law or makes it much more difficult to enforce, Democrats could lose as many as 19 congressional seats, putting control of the House effectively out of reach for the foreseeable future. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to NPR News from Washington. The sales numbers for pop star Taylor Swift's The Life of a Showgirl are coming in. NPR's Hazel Sills reports that her album is a record-breaking success.
This week, Taylor Swift's The Life of a Showgirl reaches number one on the Billboard Albums chart, and all of its songs top the Billboard Hot 100, including The Fate of Ophelia, at number one. It's her 15th number one album on the chart, which means she's now had more number one albums than Jay-Z and Drake, whom she was previously tied with. She's also now the musical act who has the second most number one albums in the history of the Billboard chart, behind the Beatles. Overall, the album has sold more than 4 million equivalent album units. That's the combo of sales and streaming that Billboard uses to rank albums each week. And a whopping 1,334,000 copies on vinyl. Hazel Sills, NPR News.
Grammy-winning artist D'Angelo has died. The R&B singer passed away from cancer, according to his family statement that was released yesterday. He was 51 years old. Critics say D'Angelo created extraordinary music. One of these included his 2000 video called Untitled, How Does It Feel? This is from the album Voodoo that won D'Angelo his first two Grammys. Funeral services for D'Angelo have not yet been announced. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR produce programming that meets the highest standards of public service in journalism and cultural expression.
Welcome to MN90, Minnesota History in 90 Seconds.
Leanne Chin was a seamstress by day, chef by night, raised by the tasty flavors of her father's grocery store back home in China. Upon moving to Minnesota in 1956, Leanne faced a huge cultural shock when she had to adjust to the extreme cold and predominantly white community of Minnesota. In her Minnesota basement, she cultivated a garden with beans, bok choy, and eggplant, gradually mastering the art of cooking the dishes she loved from back home. Working as a seamstress to support her family, Leanne's culinary skills gained recognition when she decided to cook a luncheon as a thank you for her sewing clients. Encouraged by their overwhelmingly positive response, she began teaching others how to cook the dishes she made, and she also started catering, which laid the foundation for what would become the renowned Leanne Chin restaurant chain. In the 1980s, the chain experienced significant growth throughout the Twin Cities, catching the attention of major investors like Sean Connery and the owner of the Minnesota Twins. Despite a temporary setback in the national expansion plan, the restaurant became a beloved fixture in Minnesota history.
MN90 is produced by Ampers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities. Made possible by funding from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Online at mn90.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Layla Faldin. Good morning. The ceasefire in Gaza is being put to the test.
So far, Hamas and Israel have exchanged surviving hostages and prisoners. Now, Israel says it will retaliate if Hamas does not hand over more bodies of deceased hostages. Also, President Trump is warning there could be more violence if Hamas does not give up its weapons.
If they don't disarm, we will disarm them. And it'll happen quickly and perhaps violently. But they will disarm. Do you understand me?
We have NPR's Daniel Estrin on the line from Tel Aviv to walk us through all this. Good morning.
Good morning, Leila.
So, Daniel, what is the issue over the bodies of hostages?
There were 28 bodies of hostages in total in Gaza, and they're not being released as quickly as Israelis expected. Hamas handed over 7 hostage bodies so far. They handed over an 8th body that the Israeli military says was not a hostage. Israel has been considering sanctions on Gaza as pressure to speed up the handover of bodies. The United Nations says they were told by Israel that Israel would be limiting humanitarian aid until the body issue is resolved. But this is a very sensitive issue because Israel does not want to be blowing up the ceasefire deal now before it gets the bodies back. But we just simply don't know how many bodies are in Hamas's possession and how many are under rubble or missing. Israel is conducting autopsies on the bodies that have been returned. One family says an autopsy revealed that their son was killed by Israeli bombardment while he was in captivity in Gaza.
Wow. So really a very fragile moment. What more can you tell us about the Palestinian prisoners and detainees and the Israeli hostages who were released this week and what they're saying about how they were treated?
Well, NPR's Anas Baba met some of the detainees released to Gaza. He met one journalist, Islam Ahmad, who said that he was beaten, insulted as the prisoners were moved out of prison on the way to be released. He said he lost about 30% of his body weight during the 10 months he had been held in Israel. We've also been speaking to medical staff in Israel about the freed Israeli hostages. So far, they're in mostly good health. One has had a significant eye injury. Some of their families said that they had been starved in captivity, held in shackles and chains in tunnels. One family said their son almost didn't make it out alive, that in the final days of the war, the Israeli military bombarded very close to where he was being held. And we heard at a press conference a former hostage, Yair Horn. He saw his brother get freed now, and he told reporters he was thanking President Trump.
Thanks to you, I'm standing here today, and thanks to you, my little brother is finally home.
You know, we've heard family after family of hostages thanking President Trump and his envoys. None of them have thanked Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Most of the hostage families blame him for sabotaging deals that could have released their loved ones a lot earlier.
It's only day six of the ceasefire in Gaza, and as we said earlier, it's not exactly going smoothly. Could this deal unravel?
I'd say it's being tested greatly. There have been reports of Israeli fire yesterday, killing at least six people. Fire as well today. Israel said yesterday it was firing on militants trying to cross out of the ceasefire zone. But we're also seeing this power battle with Hamas fighting in the streets, shooting up rival clans in this battle for power. We have seen that Egypt says that a committee of Palestinian technocrats vetted by Israel has been selected to take care of daily life in Gaza. Hamas won't be involved. They haven't gotten to work yet. There's also the issue of how Hamas will disarm. A lot yet to work out.
NPR's Daniel Estrin in Tel Aviv. Thank you, Daniel.
You're welcome.
As Daniel just mentioned, this is still the early stages of the Gaza ceasefire deal. One part of that involved a commitment from Israel to let in 600 trucks per day of humanitarian aid. But Israel today kept a key border crossing from Egypt to Gaza closed and cut in half the amount of aid it's allowing in retaliation for what it says are delays in the handover of hostage remains from Hamas. To talk about this, we're joined now by Jonathan Fowler. He's with the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestine Refugees, known as UNRWA, and he joins us from Amman, Jordan. Good morning.
Good morning.
So it sounds like we have a bit of a delay on the line, but we'll go ahead. Jonathan, is any aid flowing into Gaza right now?
There is some aid going in, but clearly the amount is falling far short of what is necessary for the survival of the population. I mean, this is a territory of more than 2 million people who's basically been in a man-made famine and starved through lack of aid for many months. And then when aid was finally resumed partially in May, the flow of aid was incredibly insufficient. What's coming in now is something is better than nothing, but it's close to nothing.
Your organization, where is the aid right now? Are you getting what you need in?
This is a big problem because the ban that was imposed on aid supplies coming in March has not been lifted for us. And the reason this is such a problem is we have around half of the United Nations stocks in the proximity of the Gaza Strip that could start going in immediately if we were given a green light. I mean, for example, we have enough food for the whole population for around 3 months. We've got most of our stuff is stored in Egypt, so it's right next to the Gaza Strip, or it's here in Jordan, where I'm speaking from, which is, you know, a couple of hours' drive away. So it's achingly close, but it's just not allowed in. And this has to change. It has to change overnight because lives depend on this.
How much is your ability to operate hampered by Israel's broad accusations that UNRWA staff members were involved in the October 7th attack? I mean, for context here, it's an allegation Israel has made with scant evidence. The UN carried out its own investigation and found that 9 of thousands of staff members could have been involved and fired them. And how much is it just the broad ban, or how much is it hampering your particular staff?
Yes, so regarding the allegations, of course, they've never been independently corroborated. And in fact, even in the 9 cases, it was not possible to substantiate them. So it was it was highly conditional, put it that way. But indeed, I mean, this was then used by the Israeli authorities as an argument for pushing through Parliament, the Israeli Parliament, a law to outright ban our activities in what Israel considers its sovereign territory. In that case, that's East Jerusalem. But then to prevent any contact contact with UNRWA by Israeli officials, which is problematic in any situation, but particularly problematic in a situation of a humanitarian disaster. Having said that, we have continued to operate on the ground in the Gaza Strip. We have 12,000 staff in the Gaza Strip who have been working flat out during this war, doing, for example, medical care for thousands of people, water supply, sanitation, psychological support for people with trauma, all of these kind of things, and indeed an element of schooling. I mean, it's more like informal learning because, of course, the kids are not in school. So we've been able to continue doing that inside the Gaza Strip, but we've, of course, faced this problem that we cannot get the aid in. But, you know, humanitarian operations are incredibly complex, and different organizations along the chain may do different things. So the key thing here is that whoever and however aid is got into the Gaza Strip, it is going to have to be distributed through UNRWA's network of team members, go through UNRWA's warehousing inside the Gaza Strip. And also, we have an incredibly robust system of registration. So we know if somebody comes to collect aid, they've received their aid for their quota for, you know, a week or something like that. So they can't come back tomorrow and get more.
Really quickly, even if 600 trucks were allowed in tomorrow, is that enough to meet the needs?
That's a sort of benchmark minimum, which was applied during the previous ceasefire from January to March this year. It's not, you know, people living a glorious life because of that amount. We're talking about that is the minimum required for survival. Anything less than that is just less, and therefore the consequences on the ground are stark.
Jonathan Fowler is a spokesperson with the United Nations Relief Agency known as UNRWA. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Back here in the U.S., Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro says he is grateful for the closure now that the man who firebombed the governor's mansion when he and his family were sleeping is going to prison for 25 to 50 years. The man pled guilty yesterday as part of a deal with prosecutors who just released the surveillance video used to bring charges against him. Tom Reese from member station WESA has this report.
6 months ago, 38-year-old Cody Ballmer scaled a fence, smashed windows, gained entry, and threw beer bottles filled with gasoline inside the governor's state-owned residence in Harrisburg, setting it ablaze. 22 people were inside, many of them overnight guests asleep after celebrating the Jewish holiday of Passover with the family hours earlier. Governor Shapiro said at a Tuesday news conference that before the attack, the threat of political violence felt abstract.
Those risks just felt very theoretical to me. Something that might happen elsewhere to someone else, but couldn't happen here. Sadly, this made it all real.
The governor was a keynote speaker at a recent Pittsburgh conference to combat hate-fueled violence. And Shapiro has repeatedly said that folks should not become numb in the face of growing political violence in the U.S. Dauphin County District Attorney Fran Chardo, the lead prosecutor, said surveillance footage made public showed Ballmer carried out the attack quickly and showed his, quote, sophistication level. He used Molotov cocktails and a hammer, a tool that Chardo said had a dual purpose.
It was used as a matter of entry, but it was also a weapon. And it could have been used if he came upon any of those. There were 22 people in that house, and 20 of them were sleeping. And one of those sleeping was the governor, who was his principal target. So it was a potential deadly weapon.
Pennsylvania officials say they've overhauled security at the residence since the attack, but have provided limited details, citing privacy and safety concerns. Republican state lawmakers have called on the state police, who protect the governor, to release the third-party report on possible security lapses. But consultants have said the sensitive nature of the review means it won't be made public. For NPR News, I'm Tom Reese in Harrisburg.
This is NPR News. Thank you.
Dixie was first on the air in 1976. Recently, a couple of the founders, Rich and Susie McClear, stopped by to talk about why KEXE was needed then.
A lot of people were up here thinking they were doing their own thing. And when the radio station came on the air, they found a neighbor was doing the same thing, or somebody across town, and it magically became a, there are a lot of us up here that have the same thoughts, the same activities.
Neighbors talking to neighbors. We help them get in contact with each other and talk to each other about common problems.
KEXE is still needed now. We're connected through green cheese trivia, through great music and events. We're in crisis mode. We have had all of our funding cut from the federal government. Please help us out. You can text the word donate to 218-326-1234. I'm Heidi Holton. Thank you so much for your support.
It comes from this station and from Odoo, maker of all-in-one management software with the goal of being simple to use for all employees. Learn more about Odoo at odoo.com. From Amazon Prime Video, presenting Lazarus from mystery writer Harlan Coben, a tale of lies, murder, and long-buried family secrets, starring Sam Claflin and Bill Nighy, premieres October 22nd on Prime Video. From Fisher Investments, Fisher's dedicated team of specialists provide resources on investing, retirement income, estate planning, and more. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Fela Kuti is one of the most influential musicians of the 20th century. That's a quote, and in fact, it's the mission statement for a new podcast series by Jad Abumrad. Abumrad was the co-host of the public radio program Radiolab, and he recently won a prestigious Peabody Award for his series Dolly Parton's America. The first two episodes of his new podcast are available now. It's called Fela Kuti, Fear No Man. Jen, I'm going to take one of the questions that you asked in the podcast, and I'm going to ask you, how do you describe Fela Kuti to somebody who doesn't know?
You could call him, you know, the Nigerian James Brown, because there are elements of funk in his style. It's got jazz, it's got West African drumming, but that doesn't really capture him because there's layers and layers of movement, politics, so you'd have to, like, add in a Malcolm X and a Muhammad Ali. He's all of those people in one because he was making music that, you know, was just great to dance to. I mean, it still kills at a party.
Mm-hmm.
But he was also structuring his music so that the people dancing would have these moments of awakening. And they would suddenly, like, step back and look at their lives and think, my God, look at this madness. We have to do something.
I saw the light.
I was just like, you know, like,
he sucks you in, and then he has that light bulb effect on you. Mm. You come into yourself, and you know, it's a moment of introspection too, because you realize that you haven't been as attuned as you probably should have.
All the stuff he was singing was just new to me. You know, I was just learning so much about Nigerian history through Fela that I had not learned in school.
So, Nigeria became independent from British colonial rule in 1960. So tell us what was happening in Nigeria around the same time that Fela Kuti was becoming popular.
Yeah, so, you know, right around 1960, when the country declared its independence, there was this wave of optimism, and a lot of the, you know, European
expats
educated
started going home, right?
Yeah, they started coming home to try and build the nation. The wave of optimism kind of, like, crashed on the shore and receded and left big chunks of foam behind, because these sort of neo-colonial structures built around oil money sort of came in. And then you basically had the Nigerian ruling class beholden to British gas companies, and then German, and then American. And then there was corruption that came on the heels of that. Fela really is the voice, I would say. He's the soundtrack of that post-independence falling of optimism and rising of cynicism. He's the guy who says, this isn't okay, what's happening. We need to do something.
You have an entire episode about his most popular song, Zombie. So tell us about how that piece was received, first by fans, and then by the military leadership of Nigeria.
To say it's a flagrant attack on the regime would actually be an understatement. It's basically calling the soldiers brainless droids. Zombie, oh, zombie. Zombie, oh, zombie. They kill when they're told to kill. They go left when they're told to go left. They die when they're told to die. And the song was immediately banned on the radio. You couldn't play it. But apparently it was playing out of every house, every shanty across Lagos. I mean, he really, really poked the military in the eye. So in 1977, there was an altercation with the police. They came and they burned his compound down. And apparently one of the inciting incidents was that Fela got up on top of the roof with his sax and he played Zombie down to the soldiers. So that song really became the point at which even some of his followers thought he had taken it too far.
You know, I can't gloss over just how much brutality Fela endured, right? You've just told us about how his compound was attacked multiple times, right? His mother was thrown from a second-story window.
Mm-hmm.
She would later die from complications following that incident. He was riddled with scars from past injuries. There's like a famous picture of him.
It's crazy, yeah.
What effect did you think that had on him?
When they threw his mother out of a window, that's when you really see him, a shift happen in him. And his, you know, we talked to his kids who talked about, that's when he starts getting into some like questionable spiritual practices.
He spent the rest of his life trying to communicate with his mom. So a lot of charlatans could come to him and tell him, ah, fella, I'm communicating directly with your mom. And he would listen to them because of that need.
It's at that point where you really see the cost, where, you know, ultimately the state does win, unfortunately, you know.
Why do you say that?
The violence basically extracted a toll that was maybe too much for him to bear. But in the long run, what I find really beautiful about Fela's story is that you see protest movements, like long after his death, you know, in 2020, as the George Floyd protests were happening in America. In Nigeria, you had the Ansars movement, which is a protest also against police brutality. And there, you know, you had tens of thousands of young people in the streets all playing Fela. Like he's still soundtracking these freedom movements. So there is some way in which, you know, there is a kind of endless return of him that speaks to a kind of immortality.
1,000 soldiers, them they come. Left,
right, left, right. That's Jack Abumrad. His new podcast series is called Fela Kuti, Fear No Man. The first two episodes are streaming now. More are coming on Wednesdays. Jed, thank you so much for talking with us, and thanks so much for this work.
Oh, my God, thank you so much, Michelle. This has been such an honor.
We are these 1,000 soldiers, them they go.
This is NPR News.
When Broadway shows flop or have a short run, the curtains don't have to close for good. Some musicals are getting a second life in schools.
When you get out there tonight, you've worked hard, you know what you're doing, shine that light.
I'm Alyssa Nadworny, inside a regional theater production of the Britney Spears musical on the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
And you can hear All Things Considered later today at 4 o'clock with your local host, Jennifer Barr. You're tuned in to the Wednesday morning show. I'm Andrew DeZingle. And if you love KXE's Tuesday nature programs, we got some exciting news for you. KXE is bringing you a brand new podcast. Debuting this Thursday is KAXE Season Watch Pod with hosts Charlie Mitchell, Heidi Holton, John Latimer, and a rotating cast of characters. a podcast for the curious filled with the delights of nature. Lakes Area United Way has their 25th annual chili cook-off today from 11 to 1 at the Northern Pacific Center in Brainerd. Your entry fee will allow you to sample a variety of chilies plus dessert. And Northern Exposure to Lifelong Learning welcomes Doug Oman at the Bagley American Legion today at 9:30. Oman will talk about the Barns of Minnesota. Coats for Kids will distribute winter gear for children this Saturday from 9 to 2 at the Westgate Mall in Brainerd. Use the entrance by the former Joann's store. And Watermark Arts Center hosts a Story Slam tomorrow night at Bemidji Brewing. Music begins at 6 with stories at 7. This month's theme is Scared Stupid. Stories should be 5 minutes or less. Find more information at watermarkartcenter.org. And take a walk on the Haunted Trail at Northland Arboretum in Brainerd, October 16th through 18th, from 7 to 9 each evening. Choose from low scare, high scare, or insane high scare options. The Beltrami County History Center hosts a panel discussion Saturday, October 18th at 10 a.m., Designing the Future, Women in Engineering. We'll highlight three women who are shaping the region's infrastructure and innovation. And there's a waffle brunch fundraiser for a new park in Deer River, Sunday, October 19th from 9 to 1 at the Deer River Vets Club. Tickets available at the door or in advance at the Chocolate Dog. Now it's time for your daily dose of phonology.
On today's date, October 15th, in the years 2001, 2015, and again in 2017, I have notes indicating that the big tooth aspen reached their last peak of color. And in the aggregate, it turns out that the big tooth aspen tend to reach their peak of color right about the middle of October. And when they have reached their peak of color, in some years, in years where you've had a nice warm summer with lots of moisture and enough sunlight, you get a real excess of sugars in the plant. And in those years, the big tooth aspen leaves can become almost a fluorescent orange. Think of that deer hunter's jacket color orange. And some years, the big tooth aspen way up at the tops of the trees just shine with a bright, bright orange. I can recall one day walking in the woods and thinking that the sun was shining on the top of this one big tooth aspen. But it wasn't a sunny day. It was a cloudy day, and it was just that bright, bright orange color that stood out so vibrantly against that gray sky and really, really caught the eye. So as we move into the middle of October, keep an eye on the big tooth aspens. They can put on quite a show when the weather's just right.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from CFP, Certified Financial Planner Professionals, committed to acting in their clients' best interests. Learn more at letsmakeaplan.org. From Uma, a cloud-based phone service for any size business, with an automated virtual receptionist, video meetings, and other features to connect to customers and coworkers anywhere at uma.com/NPR. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Fadel. Good morning. By the close of business today, dozens of reporters covering the Pentagon for major news outlets will have to turn in the badges giving them access to the building. That's because almost all news organizations, including NPR, have rejected new policies for journalists from the Defense Secretary. NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik reports.
Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth spoke at the White House yesterday, complaining that reporters failed to give President Trump enough credit for the Israel-Hamas ceasefire. Hegseth also defended the new demands he has placed on the press corps that covers the Pentagon.
So it's common sense stuff, Mr. President. We're trying to make sure national security is respected, and we're proud of the policy.
The policy bans disclosure of information that is not authorized by the Pentagon for public release, even if that information is not classified. Hegseth has accused news organizations of wanting to be able to roam freely throughout the Pentagon and asking people to divulge secrets. So far, only the right-wing pro-Trump outfit One America News Network has signed on to the policy. NPR Pentagon correspondent Tom Bowman says he'd rather turn in his badge after 28 years than make that promise. Here's what Bowman said last night on NPR's All Things Considered.
That turns us into stenographers and not reporters. That basically means we just parrot what the government tells us, much like you would see in countries, authoritarian ones, where the government places sharp controls on the press.
As he took office, Hegseth promised to make the Pentagon the most transparent in U.S. history. Instead, Hegseth and his aides have kept reporters largely at bay, refusing to share information with the press and narrowing further where reporters can go within the building. After Hegseth was embarrassed by early press reports, he subjected officials he suspected of leaks to lie detector tests. Hegseth was previously a weekend morning host for Fox News. That's where he caught Trump's eye. Fox joined with other TV networks in refusing to sign this pledge, collectively saying, quote, "The policy is without precedent and threatens core journalistic protections." In a statement sent to NPR, Chief Pentagon spokesperson Sean Parnell said the pledge just highlights what Defense Department personnel can tell the press. He wrote that the policy does not ask reporters to agree, quote, just to acknowledge that they understand what our policy is. Parnell accused news outlets of having, quote, a full-blown meltdown, crying victim online. Media advocacy groups say the Pentagon is straying into prior restraint, that is, determining what a private and free press can report before publication. That practice was barred under a Supreme Court ruling more than 50 years ago. It's commonly called the Pentagon Papers case. David Folkenflik, NPR News.
For a perspective on the Pentagon's restrictive new press policy, we've called somebody who's been on both sides of the microphone, Pete Williams. He began his career as a journalist, then became a congressional press secretary, and later assistant secretary of defense for public affairs under former President George H.W. Bush. He then returned to journalism as an award-winning correspondent for NBC News, and he's with us now. Pete Williams, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning to you. My pleasure.
So let me just fact check some things. Hegseth tweeted that members of the press will no longer be allowed to, quote, roam free. Has that ever been true?
No, it's not. And, you know, I was always proud of the fact that uniquely or nearly uniquely among all defense establishments around the world, the Pentagon always had reporters inside the building where all the Pentagon officials came to work. I thought that was a matter of pride.
More seriously, he tweeted that media will no longer be allowed to, quote, solicit criminal acts. That's a very serious allegation. I mean, given that media people and politicians often disagree about what kind of information should be reported on, is there any merit to the claim that journalists are, quote, soliciting criminal acts?
Well, that would be true if, in theory, you were asking someone to reveal classified information. If you were in cahoots with them, that's potentially an illegal act. But just asking them what's going on and what do you think of what the leadership is doing is hardly illegal. The policy says that you are encouraging employees to break the law because that kind of thing falls outside the scope of news gathering activities. That is what news gathering activities are. And I think it simply means the Pentagon leadership wants to try to control what gets reported. And it also means that military personnel need approval before they can share information with reporters, which makes you wonder whether the current leadership really trusts people in uniform.
So, you know, President Trump defended this yesterday, speaking for the defense secretary. He said, I think he finds the press to be very disruptive in terms of world peace and maybe security for our nation. Did you find that to be true in your time as a Pentagon spokesperson?
No, of course not. And, you know, there are times when the leadership of any government agency may find what reporters do a little annoying. But, you know, that's what comes with a democracy. And if the policy is really intended, I think, to stop critical stories about the Secretary of Defense and his leadership team, and if that's the goal, it's not going to work because reporters can still learn what they need to know without setting foot in the building.
I was going to ask you about that. Can they do their jobs without being in the building?
Well, sure. I mean, they can. It's not as easy. They probably won't be as good. But, you know, there's still people still have phones. They can still meet with them after hours. So it's not going to, if their theory is that it'll stop critical stories about Hegseth and the leadership, it's not going to work. But I would make one other point. Mm-hmm. I think, number one, of course, it's not in the interest of journalists, but it's not in the interest of the Pentagon either, because when I was the spokesman there, I found it essential to have journalists close at hand when I needed to reach them to urge corrections or suggest approaches in reporting or provide guidance to avoid mistakes. It's good to have them around.
What about to the public? I mean, the public at large. I mean, I think I hear what you're saying. You're saying from the standpoint of trying to explain the functioning of the work of the building to the public at large, it's helpful to have proximity to people. It's helpful to know them. It's helpful to understand their deadlines and their work environment and so forth. But what about the public at large? I mean, obviously, we live in a time when, you know, a smaller percentage of the population has actually had active duty military experience because we have an all-volunteer force for several generations now. I mean, what do you think the public might lose as a consequence of this?
Well, that's the key point, because more and more Americans have no contact with the military. And so the only thing they know about what's going on at the Pentagon is what they read in the news media. And it's just not enough for the secretary to put out social media tweets. We're becoming more and more distant with our military, and that's not a good thing. So anything like this that puts further distance between the reporters and the military is counterproductive. It's just a bad idea, and it's not going to do the Defense Department any good.
We only have about 30 seconds left, but do you, as we mentioned, numerous media outlets, including this one and Fox News, have rejected this policy. Do you see any way this resolves?
Well, one way might be in court. There's already talk about lawsuits to challenge this. I don't know how successful that will be. For now, the Pentagon seems pretty hard over on this. My hope is that they realize that this is just a bad idea and that they'll back away from it after a little time passes.
That's Pete Williams, former Assistant Secretary of Defense for Public Affairs. He served in the administration of President George H.W. Bush. Pete Williams, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
This is NPR News.
Green Cheese listeners know how important it is to support stations like KAXE KBXE.
Anyone who can, be sure to donate, because as all of us know, we listen to this Green Cheese and all the other programming on the stations. We really, really love it and don't want anything to happen to it. So it's really important to give what you can.
One thing I wanted to do is I wanted to talk to everybody out there. Radio is important when it's unique and it's interesting and it's local. And given your current funding situation, everybody out there should be doing something about that, no matter how little it is. If everybody did something, it makes a tremendous difference. Think about Saturday nights with no green cheese. That sounds terrible.
It would be so boring.
This is the queen, and I'm going to make an edict. All cheeses, get your checkbooks out and send in some money to our favorite station and show, and my check will be in the mail tomorrow.
Donate now at KAXE.org. You are tuned in to Morning Edition here on the Wednesday Morning Show here on member-supported radio, KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. After Dark is KAXE Saturday night program after Green Cheese from 9 to midnight, featuring styles of music like punk, metal, EDM, R&B, hip-hop, and more. This week's host, Jay Steelwolf, will be playing heavy metal. Interested in hosting? Email dgannon at kaxe.org. There's an Indigenous and Community Health Fair Tuesday, October 21st from noon to 5 at the Armory Arts and Events Center in Park Rapids. Find community health resources and participate in Indigenous traditions like dancing, drumming, and beading. Fresh Energy and Partners presents the Renew Highway 2 Tour Wednesday, October 22nd from 9 to 3:30 at the Beaux-Arts Ballroom on the Bemidji State University campus. It's a day full of workshops and presentations about renewable energy. Find more details and register at fresh-energy.org. The Beltrami County History Society in Bemidji invites you to this year's History Mystery, Friday, October 24th and Saturday, October 25th at 5:30. Actors will present the story of Emma Davids, and their audience members will step into the role of detective. Find tickets and more information at beltramihistory.org. Now we'll take you back to more Morning Edition here on KAXE KBXE.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. From BritBox, committed to helping viewers to see it differently with British TV, with new original series like Code of Silence, about a deaf woman recruited as a lip reader in a high-stakes police investigation. Streaming at BritBox.com. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Fadil. More than 20 children in India have died over the last 2 months after taking contaminated cough syrup. This is not a new problem for low and middle income countries without strong regulation enforcement. A report finds international criminal activity is to blame. NPR's Gabriella Emmanuel explains.
When Saifuddin Ahmed saw the headlines in India, he had one thought.
This is not some sort of accident. This is intentionally done it to reduce the cost of the drug and to pocket more money.
Ahmed is a physician and at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. He says drug manufacturers use a pharmaceutical-grade liquid to create the cough syrup. What went wrong here is that liquid was diluted or replaced with another liquid that's much cheaper and looks very similar, but it's poisonous.
This is developed for industrial purpose. It's an antifreeze in their radiators.
The cough syrup is often marketed for kids. Naseem Hoodridge is with the World Health Organization. He says when children ingest it with that antifreeze chemical,
the children stop passing urine. They have an inability to actually pee.
He says the kidneys, which filter blood and make urine, are trying to remove the toxic chemicals.
These are very young children, they're very small, and their kidneys are simply overwhelmed by the toxins.
Many die of acute kidney injury. Hoodridge started working on this issue in 2022 when more than 65 kids died in the Gambia from contaminated cough syrup. A few months later, kids in Indonesia started dying. Then kids in Uzbekistan were dying, hundreds of kids in total.
So it wasn't the same manufacturer, it wasn't the same product, and it wasn't the same country. So this was too much of a coincidence.
That's when WHO teamed up with the United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime to unravel what was happening. Murad Yildiz worked on the investigation.
We see that there's a role of corruption, negligence, intentional or unintentional sort of efforts to enter into the supply chains.
He says they found a litany of problems. One is that there's no established way to recycle the huge plastic or steel drums used to transport the pharmaceutical grade liquid. That means those drums can end up in the hands of criminals who then refill them with the cheaper toxic liquid and sell them at a profit.
There is an online market for secondhand drums.
Another challenge, Hoodridge says, is just how global pharmaceutical manufacturing has become. Ingredients are made in one country, manufacturing in another, then it's sold elsewhere.
There are, for lack of a better word, bad guys who exploit this global nature. They exploit regulatory gaps.
The international nature of the problem also makes it very difficult to prosecute because there's not an easy way to go after a criminal in another country. But even when there has been prosecution,
the punishments are really, really, really low.
India has arrested the owner of the factory that produced the contaminated cough syrup. Officials did not respond to NPR's request for comment. Ahmed of Johns Hopkins believes that more needs to be done.
It is not the issue of only India. The whole world is at risk of this type of the threat because many of these drugs are also exported.
He worries that when these deaths fade from the headlines, nothing will happen until the next tragedy. Gabriella Emanuel, NPR News.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldig.
And I'm Michelle Martin.
This is Drew Miller from Boiled in Lead, urging you to support KAXE and KBXE. Community radio is a lifeline for culture, and these days it's under threat. If you enjoy it, you need to help pay for it, because nobody else is going to do it except for you. Please support KAXE and the Summer Pledge Drive.
Make a donation now by visiting our website, kaxe.org, and clicking the word donate, or text donate to 218-326-1234.
Climbing up that old gallows ladder, cried out so gaily for his high white cap and feather. I've always been a lively lad, never murdered.
When new technology changes the world, is it worth all the intense disruption? We consult an authoritative source.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Bitwarden, with the reminder that a password manager for business is designed to be an investment in protecting employees, executives, and IT teams. Bitwarden.com. And by WSJ Plus, a news bundle offering global insights and market tools from four business and finance publications, so readers can explore every angle.
I'm David Brancaccio in Los Angeles. We begin our program here with a conversation with a Marketplace listener. He spends a lot of time, about a half hour north on the train from Chicago. Oh, and he won the Nobel Economics Prize this week. Joel Mokyr is a professor at Northwestern University who, along with fellow Nobel winners Philippe Aguillon and Peter Howitt, studies how technology and culture mix. Mokyr himself looks at history to understand how open exchanges between scholars and people who make things inspire each other for enduring economic growth. Professor Mokyr, first of all, congratulations.
Thank you so much.
Well, I'm glad that the culture of growth that you've long written about is here and is ingrained. And when you look at the famed hockey stick graph of the economy over centuries, not much, then boom, up it goes with innovation. It all seems like it's here to stay, this culture of growth. But what's your view? Could we still mess this up?
Count on the human race to mess things up. It's institutions that screw up. That, I think, is a huge concern. Because if institutions don't improve while technology improves, you're giving more and more power to people who are likely to abuse and misuse it.
Yeah, and a new challenge emerging, right? The emergence of this revolutionary technology, artificial intelligence. One expects it to increase economic growth, but you also want the other piece of this, not just growth, but indeed prosperity, right?
Yes, indeed. And, I'm actually not worried about it. I don't share this sort of apocalyptic view of artificial intelligence that it's going to replace the human race. And, you know, I think AI is another tool for us to do research. And it will make our knowledge, you know, much more advanced, much faster than it did before. And I'm all for that. I don't think any of the pessimistic predictions about AI will come through. But I wish I could say the same about institutions and politics.
Well, I mean, indeed, that does bring us back to your previous point, that institutions and politics would have to evolve along with this technology so that the technology, for instance, doesn't get abused.
Here is the dilemma. In the past, we've had major technological changes, but that change was relatively slow. And so institutions had the time to adjust, you know, so labor relations changed, you know, the organization of work changed, and it all worked out reasonably well. But if technological change is very, very quick, then institutions will fall behind. And once that disequilibrium occurs, societies could be in trouble and things could happen that nobody expects.
Yeah. And with all this disruption, it's a little hard to plan one's training and career. You've thought about that, right? We just don't know with technological advances what the big jobs will be.
You always have people who end up on the losing end of the stick. And, you know, that there's not very little you can do. But the alternative is worse, right? So if you have a society which is completely technologically stagnant, in which there's very little progress, I would say what society should do is, above all, they should understand that this is happening and give people perhaps a kind of training that is more flexible, that is more adaptable, that is more agile. So if you are trained for one task and then it turns out to become obsolete, you can easily switch to another task. But it's the price you pay for progress, David. There's no other way.
Northwestern's Joel Mokyr, who along with Philippe Aguillon and Peter Howitt, are winners of this year's Nobel Economics Prize. Professor, again, congratulations.
Thank you so much, David.
We embrace multi-channel technological change. More with the Econ Nobel winner at marketplace.org. Now, there's no reading on September inflation that had been due today because of the government shutdown. It will come out next week because we need it to calculate cost of living adjustments for Social Security. S&P futures are up 0.6% now.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Trevi Pay, a managed B2B payments platform for global brands, offering zero-touch AR plus tools to help reduce DSO at TreviPay.com. And by Schwab. Schwab offers investors choices like full-service wealth management, self-directed investing options, and trading on thinkorswim. More at Schwab.com.
The bankruptcies of a car parts supplier and a subprime car and truck lender are causing angst on Wall Street. These failures are raising questions about private credit markets and big banks' exposure to them. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer joins us now. Nancy, which companies?
Well, David, the two companies here are First Brands and Tricolor Holdings. And First Brands sells things like windshield wiper blades and spark plugs, and Tricolor lends to low-income subprime car buyers. First Brands borrowed a lot of money to buy smaller parts suppliers. Much of that borrowing, though, didn't appear on its balance sheet, so its creditors didn't know it was in trouble.
So how might be big banks involved? Did First Brands borrow from them?
In some cases, mostly, though, First Brands borrowed from private investors, and that borrowing was coordinated through Wall Street lenders like Jefferies. First Brands used money it was expecting from invoices as collateral, but it may have pledged those invoices more than once for multiple loans.
Now, key question here, might this snowball the contagion effect?
Well, the big banks say no. They say they don't have much exposure to this type of borrowing. In an earnings call yesterday, though, J.P. Morgan CEO Jamie Dimon did acknowledge the bank had to write off $170 million because of the Tricolor bankruptcy. David, he used some colorful language to warn there may be more companies with similar problems. He said, when you see one cockroach, there are probably more. So he said there could be some excess in the private credit markets. But other banks like Citigroup say they're not affected by the bankruptcies, and they don't see warning signs of major distress in the private credit markets.
All right, we'll keep watching this, right? Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer, thank you very much. In Los Angeles, I'm David Brancaccio, and this is the Marketplace Morning Report from APM, American Public Media.
This is 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji, A9.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker, we are people-powered radio in northern Minnesota. Join us at kaxe.org. On the River is our volunteer-hosted mix of folk, rock, jazz, blues, and world music on KAXE 7 days a week. Trained community members choose the music every weekday at 1 and 7, plus Saturdays at 4 and Sundays at 1. Big thanks to our dedicated volunteers. Brainerd Community Theater presents Dracula, a comedy of terrors, October 23rd through November 1st at the Chalberg Theater on the campus of Central Lakes College in Brainerd. Find more information at clcperformingarts.com. Grassroots Concerts kicks off its fall season Friday, October 24th at 7.